Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas, Pop Pop.
Christmas magic.
Christmas magic.
Comes every time each year.
Woo! Christmas magic.
And all the cold, hungry people.
Christmas magic. Christmas bridesmaid.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and
hello and welcome to a very special holiday edition of Sound, Sight, and Mind. I am Steve Andre, and with me today, as always, are Ken.
Ho, ho, ho.
And Chris.
Hello there.
And we're going to be doing just a mini-episode, a mini-sode, I believe the parlance of the podcast is, talking about Twilight Zone's very special holiday episode, The Night of the Meek, or just Night of the Meek, actually. And we're also, for the first time, going to dip kind of in-depth on the 1980s Twilight Zone revival with their remake of the Night of the Meek episode.
Well, point of order, the original is The Night of the Meek. The remake is Night of the Meek.
All right. So
that
I was
crucial
right.
The. You were right.
Either way. Okay. As long as I'm right in some way, that's the only thing that matters.
Absolutely.
All right. So let's jump right in. The Night of the Meek. The original Twilight Zone episode from the season 2, episode 11, directed by Jack Smite, written by Rod Serling, originally aired on December 23rd, 1960. Stars Art Carney, John Fiedler, Robert P. Lieb, and then a few other people filling in some various roles there. So the episode opens with a department store busy and bustling, and there's a line to see Santa, but Santa is not there. And the store manager, who is played by John Fiedler, who I recognized immediately as the voice of Piglet on the Winnie the Pooh cartoons originally, is getting very upset that their Santa, Mr. Henry Corwin, is not showing up to work his shift. Cut to a bar where Henry Corwin is seated, drinking, dressed in a very, very shabby Santa suit and beard, ruminating about the unfairness of the world to the bartender. He leaves the bar, or gets thrown out, depending on, you know, how you look at it, sees, stumbles out in the snow, ends up kind of falling down onto his rear on the street next to a lamppost. A couple kids see him run over and start asking Santa for things to bring them, toys, dolls, and one girl says, a job for my daddy. And as Henry Corwin begins to weep holding the children, the camera pans over to Mr. Rod Serling standing in the snow, and here is Rod Serling's opening narration.
This is Mr. Henry Corwin, normally unemployed, who once a year takes the lead role in the uniquely popular American institution, that of the department store Santa Claus, in a road company version of The Night Before Christmas. But in just a moment, Mr. Henry Corwin, ersatz Santa Claus, will enter a strange kind of North Pole, which is one part the wondrous spirit of Christmas and one part the magic that can only be found in the Twilight Zone.
So we cut back to the department store where Henry Corwin goes in, stumbles back to his post and is ready to see some of the children, obviously still very inebriated, tumbles off his chair, creating a scene. The mother of one child gets very upset and speaks to the store manager, Mr. Dundee, who basically fires Corwin there. And Corwin gives a very impassioned speech about why he's ashamed, and basically saying that shame that he's living in a dirty rooming house on a street filled with hungry kids and shabby people who won't know the joys of Christmas. And Christmas is finer than people barging up and down department store aisles and pushing people out of the way. And he goes on and on for quite a bit before he finally leaves. And then he's walking down the silent, snowy streets, down an alleyway, when he passes just a bag of refuse. As he walks past, suddenly hears some sleigh bells ringing, looks back, and the bag, which was filled with trash, is suddenly filled with wrapped gifts. Very excited, he picks up the bag and runs and starts calling to the kids, Merry Christmas! Merry Christmas, kids! And cuts to the commercial. When it comes back, we see a sort of a Salvation Army kind of shelter, wherein they're having what could be described as a Christmas party, I guess. It's very... I wouldn't want to be there.
Well, they do say it's a Christmas service. She gets very...
Christmas service.
The,
okay,
the
that's
sister
a little bit,
there really
that's true.
Gets upset when he bursts in and interrupts.
Yes, so filled with some of the derelicts from the city. You can tell these are people who are down in their luck, maybe people who are just haven't been working or, you know, just need some help. And one man comes in and says that Henry Corwin is giving out gifts, and he comes in sure enough and he starts giving people gifts from his bag, and people ask for things and he gives them exactly what they want right out of the bag. And the woman who runs the shelters and the service is getting very upset because she assumes that these are all stolen goods and he's just passing them out. So she gets the police involved. The police bring him to the station and also get his former employer, Mr. Dundee, there, figuring that most likely he stole these items from the store when he was employed there. Mr. Dundee is livid, is yelling at Henry Corwin down at the police station as he reaches into the bag to pull out what he assumes are stolen goods. But as he's reaching into the bag, all that he pulls out is more and more trash.
And a live cat.
That's when he finally realizes that it's not presents in there. He pulls out a live cat. So he doesn't know what's happening, and Henry Corwin basically tells him it's, you know, it's a miracle, it's the Christmas spirit, like, isn't there anything you would really want for Christmas? And Dundee says he'd like a bottle of brandy, I think, what did he say, like vintage 1903?
You got it, cherry yeah. brandy,
cherry brandy.
And sure enough, he pulls out a bottle of cherry brandy, vintage 1903, and Dundee's amazed, and he starts to drinking, as he do. Then we see Corwin out in the street with all the neighborhood kids around asking for presents. He's pulling all the gifts out of his bag and giving them to them. Then the kids are really happy and then leaving and running away until finally he's left by himself with an empty sack. He sits on the steps, and one of the men from the service comes out who had gotten a pipe and a smoking jacket from the magical bag. And asks him, you know, didn't you get anything yourself? Like, and Corwin says, there's nothing I want unless it would be to play Santa like this and have this happen every year. And the old man wishes him a Merry Christmas, thanks him for the pipe and the jacket, leaves, and Corwin starts to walk away when suddenly he hears those sleigh bells again. Looks over on the side of the street, there's a sleigh hooked up to reindeer, and a real live elf jumps out from behind some trash cans and says something to the effect of, you're late, we've been waiting for you, we have a whole year of work to do before next year. So disbelieving, he goes over and touches the elf to make sure that she's not, you know, Pink Elephant or another Delirium Tremens or anything like that. She's real. He climbs on board the sleigh, cracks the reins, and off they go. Then you see a very inebriated Mr. Dundee, having polished off, looks like 95% of a bottle of brandy all by himself, being escorted back home by the police officer who brought in Corwin into the station. When they hear the sleigh bells and look up overhead and realize that Corwin has just passed by overhead in a tiny sleigh driven by 8 tiny reindeer, and that's basically it. That's the Christmas miracle. And then we finish once again with Rod Serling's closing narration.
A word to the wise to all the children of the 20th century, whether their concern be pediatrics or geriatrics, whether they crawl on hands and knees and wear diapers or walk with a cane and comb their beards. There's a wondrous magic to Christmas, and there's a special power reserved for little people. In short, there's nothing mightier than the meek. And a Merry Christmas to each and all.
So that's the episode. This is one that is considered a classic. I remember back when we used to watch the marathons that would be on WPIX, This one, it always seemed like it would be this one, Eye of the Beholder, The Invaders, and Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. Like, those are the four big ones I remember. I've got some mixed feelings about it, but first I'd like to hear what you guys think.
It is a classic, and that's in spite of it being one of the six videotaped episodes, rather than filmed. It was one of the ones where, as a budget-saving measure, they shot it on tape, which Rod Serling really didn't like the look of. But in spite of that, it holds up. It's uneven. The child actors are, to a person, pretty abysmal. either really overplaying the pantomime or just not good as far as being believable child actors.
The best not good child actor is when Corwin goes back to the department store drunk and the very overbearing mother pushes her child to go see Santa. I think the kid's name is Percival
Smithers. Percival Smithers.
Tell Santa what you would like. A new front name.
That was actually a funny gag, but it's kind of lost in there, you know, because of the way it was presented. But that kid is such a bad actor. You can tell, like, he was told, like, to act snotty. Right. So the rest of it, he's just, like, standing there with his arms crossed and his, like, chin up in the air, like, meh.
Right, and the kids who go, you know, to Art Carney is, you know, to Henry Corwin and, you know, please, you know, and my a new job for my daddy, and they're so overwrought and pathetic. And what saves it, though, is Art Carney's performance, which is utterly believable as he delivers these very heavy-handed, you know, Serling lines. Yeah. It's a Serling script. Ken, do you have the audio for his speech there? Because first of all, the Night of the Meek, it's a biblical reference, right? The meek shall inherit the earth from the Beatitudes. And he does reference that directly. But it's, you know, it's Serling being Serling. It's really, do you have that?
Yeah.
As to my drinking, this is indefensible. And you have my abject apologies. I find of late that I have very little choice in the matter of expressing emotions. I can either drink or I can weep. And drinking is so much more subtle.
Will you please leave?
But as for my insubordination, I was not rude to that woman. Someone should remind her that Christmas is more than barging up and down department store aisles and pushing people out of the way.
Now, Corwin.
Someone has to tell her that Christmas is another thing finer than that. Richer, finer, truer. And it should come with patience and love. Charity, compassion. That's what I would have told her if you'd give me the chance.
Well, how philosophical, Mr. Corwin. Now, perhaps as your parting word, you can tell us how we can go about living up to these wondrous Yule standards which you have so graciously laid down for us.
I don't know how to tell you, Mr. Gundy. I don't know at all. All I know is that I'm an aging, purposeless relic of another time. And I live in a dirty rooming house on a street filled with hungry kids and shabby people, where the only thing to come down the chimney on Christmas Eve is more poverty.
Will you keep your voice down?
You know another reason why I drink, Mr. Dundee? So that when I walk down the tenements, I can really think it's the North Pole and the children are elves and that I'm really Santa Claus, bringing them a bag of wondrous gifts for all of them. I just wish, Mr. Dundee, on one Christmas, only one, that I could see some of the hopeless ones and the dreamless ones. Just on one Christmas, I'd like to see the meek inherit the earth. That's why I drink, Mr. Dundee. And that's why I weep.
and it's really melodramatic, but his delivery is just so honest. Mm-hmm. His performance in the bar, he's really a pathetic character, to the point when the bartender turns around and he tries to make a grab for the bottle, and the bartender says, "Try that again, Santa Claus, I'll break both your arms." He's really a guy who's hit rock bottom and knows it. And the interesting thing is that Art Carney himself was an alcoholic from his teenage years, by his own admission. He had terrible problems with alcohol and drug abuse, and he actually didn't get clean until he was shooting the movie for which he won an Oscar, Harry and Tonto, when he was a much older man, and he did it with the help of a drug that actually gave him a negative reaction to alcohol. It basically gives you the hangover as soon as you ingest the alcohol. And with the use of that, he was able to get sober. So here he is playing the drunk, and very, very believably so. At a time where a lot of times when you see it's this idea of the derelict Santa Claus had already been done in 1947 in Miracle on 34th Street.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at that portrayal of the drunk Santa Claus, it's the very cartoon. Man's got to do something to keep warm.
Well, it's cold. Right. Right. Do something to
right.
keep warm.
Exactly. And I don't get me wrong, I love the movie, but that's the cartoon character drunk.
I could watch that all day.
But there is such a deep emotional core to Art Carney's performance in this that you are willing to forgive just about everything else in this episode.
Yeah. I really like this episode in spite of the flaws, and even though it's shot on video and it's, you know, got that horrible video look, I think the couple things that help it are that it's got multiple locations. So as opposed to Lateness of the Hour, where you're trapped in that one room, at least being able to get around doesn't feel so much like you're watching a stage soap opera thing.
No, it was kind of ambitious, I think, to be able to do this. And they had, four different sets. They had the bar set, the street set, which was, you know, pretty extensive. They had the snow falling. They had, mm-hmm. like, cars. They had reindeer, for God's sake, on there. And then, of course, you know, they had the little, the service,
the mission.
The Salvation Army, the mission, yes, thank you, and the department store.
And even,
you know,
the camera work is, there's some interesting cinematography going on.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's pretty solid. And I think that the muddled look of the video actually helps in the case of making him look that much shabbier. There's just something more derelict about him seeing it shot in that kind of ugly video. The suit and his beard just look that much more gross to me, so it sort of works. And I think Carney's performance is great, and it's just it's like a really nice warm and fuzzy episode for me, where usually I'm not into that at all with the Twilight Zone, but because it's a Christmas thing, it gets a pass from me.
And here's the interesting thing. Serling was raised Jewish. And that, you know, that was his tradition, but he always said he had an appreciation for Christmas and the magic of Christmas as, you know, what he saw around. And he kind of came around to subscribing to Unitarian ideas, where, you know, he was willing to recognize a God and a divinity, but wasn't necessarily going to put all his eggs in one basket as far as any denomination. But he, you know, it could have been seen as, oh, well, this is just kind of a cynical holiday, you know, appeal to sentimentality, but it's something that he really believed in. And throughout Twilight Zone, you see him, you know, writing on the human condition and trying to look at people being better and helping fellow man instead of destroying. And it really comes through in this.
Mm-hmm. And he didn't like this episode at all.
Really?
Really?
Yeah,
I know he didn't like the look of it.
He certainly didn't like the look.
I know that before the episode was on, I read something about how he was very excited about it, especially getting Art Carney.
Yeah.
He saw Art Carney in a stage production and really wanted to have him doing this episode.
Yeah, they were super psyched. They were drumming up like extra promotional materials for it with advertisers because they just thought, like, you know, it's gonna be boffo, slam bang, real whiz bang. So he wrote about it. The Christmas show, instead of being the sheer delight I had hoped it would be, turned out to be an inconsequential nothing, and I rather think it'll be a terrible disappointment to you. That's what he wrote, one of the advertising firms. And then later, after viewing it, he said that the Christmas show was an abomination and looks for all the world like a rough dress rehearsal that is a couple days from coming around.
I
gotta say that part of the reason that this episode feels uneven to me is because of, again, shooting on video rather than film, they were editing it as they shot it, you know, switching from camera to camera. And so there's some things that happen that I feel like if it had been done with film and they could get it in the editing room and clean it up, it would have been a lot better. In the beginning, especially when he's in the bar, and there's one shot where it switches from kind of a wide shot of Corwin and the bartender to a very tight close-up of Corwin looking pretty much right at the camera.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a jarring cut, and there's kind of an awkward pause there. And there's a couple other moments like that, too, where it's like the timing is not quite there. So I could see where that might have been if, you know, Rod Serling probably was harping, like a lot of us do, you know, we see the imperfections rather than what's working, and he probably was just harping on that in his mind.
Yeah, and I think he probably softened on it later, because as it became one of the classic episodes, and like there was a local school that did a stage production of it instead of doing their normal Christmas play and things like that, it became
adapted for a radio play too.
Yeah, I think, you know, once everyone sort of looked past all those visual flaws to embrace the storytelling, I'm sure he must have softened on it a little. And I think I read that he actually started screening it in his house every Christmas, like on a projector. Yeah. He got a film print of it and he would screen it. So it's a good story.
Yeah. I will say there's a couple other weird things. And this is just, again, it's a sign of the times. When the two kids in the beginning are talking to Santa, asking him for things, and the girl says, like, I want a dolly, and the boy says, I want a gun.
Yeah, I want a gun.
Like, it's not a toy gun. It's like, I want a gun. And it's like, do you want a real gun? Is he going to go knock over Bruce's liquor store?
Well, but a little 22 chipmunk rifle in the 1950s, 1960s wouldn't be out of place.
Yeah.
I guess that's true. One of the other things that I thought was kind of notable is that they did have a black child and his mother in the department store,
yep.
Which Twilight Zone, like many other programs at the time, generally was a pretty white cast all the way through.
And that was done very deliberately on Serling's part.
Yeah, because there was a very tight close-up of the boy, too. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that part of it was because, you know, Corwin's talking about the people who are, you know,
it's right on the meek inheriting the earth that they tighten up
and
on the voice.
Of course, like the way civil rights were and the sign of the times there. Yeah, definitely.
Now, I would like to see the follow-up episode that is The Morning After featuring Dundee and the officer. Because the way that ends with the officer, you're coming home with me, and we're gonna finish this bottle.
It's like, are you trying to pick him up? Yeah. Like, is this what's
it
happening?
It seems
here?
That way. It seems like might be some Christmas magic there.
Christmas magic.
You know that John? I didn't realize John Fiedler kept doing Piglet's voice for years after the rest of the Winnie the Pooh cast had been replaced.
Yeah,
many of them had passed on. In fact, the last credit he had for Disney was doing a voice for the sequel to Emperor's New Groove. He did the voice of the old man who gets tossed out the window.
Yeah, I threw off his groove.
I think he passed away in 2005 finally. But he had a long career, and usually playing, you know, little nebbishy characters. He's in 12 Angry Men. But what I like about his character in this is he's fussy, and he manages to be kind of the heavy, and that he's the one who has to fire Santa Claus and everything, but he's never overboard with it. I mean, clearly he's within mm-hmm. his rights. He's reacting, you know, as pretty much the only way he could in that situation. And it's, you know, it's just a nice little turn from a really well-known character actor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of character actors, let's go to the 1980s Twilight Zone series and the remake of The Night of the Meek.
Yes, it's true. Man has no Christmas spirit.
Night of the Meek. So the remake was from the new Twilight Zone, season 1, episode 13, although they designate it 13A, because the Twilight Zone, when it was revamped in the 80s, was an hour-long program, and each episode in itself was an anthology of different length episodes.
One had three stories to the episode.
Yep, and some of them had more, some of them had fewer. But generally, it was one long episode and then a couple smaller ones. There were a couple episodes that barely even qualify as programs. They were only something like 5 minutes, like more like a gag kind of thing. But this was the main feature in episode 13. Directed by Martha Coolidge, written by Rockne S. O'Bannon, based on the original story by Rod Serling. And this version, Night of the Meek, aired on December 20th, 1985. The plot is basically, in broad strokes, the same. You have Henry Corwin, who is department store Santa, who is also a drunk and is just kind of depressed and miserable with the world around and people who don't have enough, and again has a bag which is filled with trash, which mystically becomes full of toys and other presents that people need. You have the department store owner. In this case, Mr. Dundee is played by William Atherton, who is best known for his role as Walter Peck in the movie Ghostbusters.
Notable 80s asshole.
William Atherton, I don't think he's ever not played an asshole. Yeah. Real genius, asshole. Ghostbusters, asshole. Knight of the Meek, starts off as kind of an asshole. Mm. And then Henry Corwin, I should say, also is played by Richard Mulligan, who was a television and film actor.
Soap, later Empty Nest.
And I also remember him from the movie Little Big Man, where he played General Custer.
General Custer.
Very good in that. Another drunk in General Custer, in there, I believe. So, like I said, the plot points are basically the same, and where it's just a little bit different is in the execution and a couple little details. So rather than just give a full rehash again of what's going on, it's pretty much the same as the original episode, let's just get right down to talking about it in detail. And I will say that I actually think I prefer this version to the original. Is that sacrilege?
There are parts I'm with you. I actually saw this one first. I encountered this one as a kid. This is what I saw first. There are parts I think work better here. There are parts I think really don't. I think the story at the core of it is still so good, and that it's really tough to screw up. And and I think Richard Mulligan does a fine job in the role.
He's very good.
He's a little more understated, here it I think they tried consciously to make it a little more plausible for a more contemporary audience that isn't used to seeing the kind of heavy-handed melodrama that was common.
Well, yeah, they definitely took Rod Serling's idea and kind of trimmed down a lot of the Rod Serling excess verbiage.
Yeah, why don't for shits and giggles, let's listen to Mulligan's speech and hear the little differences.
I hope you're satisfied disappointing all those little boys and girls.
Oh, they're not going to be disappointed, Mr. Dundee. Not these kids. Tomorrow morning, they'll find everything they could possibly want under a big, beautiful Christmas tree. Doesn't really matter if they talk to a man in a red suit tonight or not. Kids who are going to be disappointed aren't in this store. They're out there. The kids in this neighborhood, and neighborhoods like it all around the world. To them, tomorrow isn't Christmas. It's just another day to survive.
Let's go.
Merry Christmas, Mr. Dundee.
Let's go.
it kind of works nicely the way he acknowledges that, you know, being in this kind of ritzy department store, those kids inside aren't necessarily the ones he's talking about, you know, they're all the privileged kids. And
right,
there's some neat little details. Mulligan's character doesn't seem to be as rock bottom as Carney's. He lives in his own apartment, apparently. It's in a kind of sketchy neighborhood. But there are some nice little touches. For example, in the beginning, the setup is the same. It's the department store. There's the close-up on the Santa Will Return. And the store guard is moving the hand on the clock for Will Return.
Yeah.
And Dundee comes and calls him out on it. So clearly, the guard is trying to help cover for Corwin, and there's some affection there. You know, it's like he's looking out for him, and Dundee yells at him. There's some other things to set up that William Atherton's character is, yes, the asshole. He's berating a store employee who apparently has somehow mistakenly sold a custom-made fur coat that he was getting for his wife. He's just being nasty to, you know, to everyone. He's telling the employee, you know, I want you and the whoever actually made the sale in my office tomorrow. And he's saying, well, it's Christmas tomorrow, and not for you, it's not
for you.
This to me was one of the slight misfires on this. The original episode, the redemptive arc is really for Corwin. He's hit the bottom, and he's here. They're almost trying to do a little Ebenezer Scrooge thing. They put a little more on, you know, Dundee getting the spirit of Christmas through Corwin's miracle, because Corwin isn't that far gone to begin with. And in fact, the scene with the bar with him, instead of trying to steal another drink while the bartender's back is turned, he's trying to get another drink on credit, and the very young bartender says, sorry, boss said cash only since last time, you know. And as he's leaving, having noticed kids out in the outside the window and everything trying to get a glimpse of Santa Claus, as he's leaving, the bartender points out that there's some money falling out of his pocket. And we get that little hint of the sleigh bells there. And and lo and behold, he pulls a couple dollars from his pocket, and the bartender says, oh, you want me to set you up again? He's like, no, that's all right. And he goes out, and then we see through the glass that he's giving those dollars to the kids. So that's a neat little turn. It's almost like there's a test. Like, you know, it's here's a little hint of the magic. Now, what are you going to do with it? And he makes the right decision. There's some other neat touches. When he's back at his apartment and he's unzipping the Santa suit, the T-shirt that he has underneath is a U.S. Coast Guard shirt. And so there's a little hint that, gee, maybe he's ex-military and hit the skids, you know, or maybe it's something he just got in a donation bin somewhere. But there's an attempt, I think, at giving a little bit of a backstory that he's somehow a really good guy who, due to whatever circumstances, is not where he should be. And that's kind of cool.
I also like the scene when he's giving the gifts to all the people, and it becomes this real celebration.
Like a block party.
Dundee drives down, and there's lights everywhere, and people on the street, kids are riding bikes, and then there's just lots of little fun bits, like the fact that the security guard, the one who had moved the clock for him, is there, and he's telling... says to Corwin, he's like, oh, we're running out of eggnog, you know, where people are drinking it all. And he's like, well, we can't have a Christmas party without eggnog. And he reaches in the bag, and out comes a pitcher of eggnog. And it's just like there's neat little touches.
And the way clearly all the lights and the decorations are things he's pulled from the bag, because the people want to be able to celebrate Christmas so badly that they're doing that. And so when Atherton's character is driving home, he's not called in by the cops. He just happens to be driving through the neighborhood and is going, what the hell? Because this is usually this slum he drives through. And all of a sudden it looks like they're festive. It's the, you know, the Grinch moment. What's this?
So what just doesn't work as magically for me is sort of the way they resolve Dundee's accusal. It's cute in the original one when he just produces that bottle of cherry brandy.
Right.
It's a fun moment, and then that's kind of the end of it. And in this one, it's the much more like concrete producing all these receipts for these goods.
Yeah.
And then, and just the fact that they all also come from his department store, to me, that would raise even more questions. You know, it's like, right. Well, what's to say those are real receipts? That doesn't mean anything. So, yeah.
Well, and then the receipts evaporate in front of his eyes. So it's, right, you know, to show the magic.
But I like that at the end when he says, like, we both know these didn't come from your store. Yeah. You know, it's a miracle, you know? And I think, yeah, it's a little bit much. I think the times dictated they needed to do something more concrete than just, right, like, it's magic.
And it allowed us to get that cameo from the cop from Clue, which I thought was...
That's true.
Now, interesting thing about that. Yeah, I picked up on him right away, so I had to go look him up. And Bill Henderson, he was actually a pretty darn famous jazz vocalist who then made a second career playing slightly befuddled cops.
Yeah. It just seemed like he wandered over from the Clue set in his uniform.
In the exact same.
It's like, you got your own uniform? Okay, come on. Yeah. We just need you to sit in the squad car for a second.
No, boss, sure. It all checks out. He's got receipts and everything, but I think my life is in danger.
No, I'm not on duty. Yeah. It's all these people having a Christmas party. And one of them is... yeah. Well, one of the other sign of the times that I really thought was funny is the girl who wants new glasses.
Right.
Oh, that, yeah.
Oh, well, just the fact that, like,
so much better.
As I was watching it, I was like, you want to hang on to those horn rims, honey, because in 30 years, those are going to be back in fashion.
And then just when she puts the new glasses on and the mom is just like, you look so beautiful. I was like, it feels like a lateral 80s. Move to me, but...
But those were
also
trendy.
Also,
there
was some big hair and shoulder pads, and she would have been ready to go.
Yeah. And then also, sign of the times, of course, instead of going with the sleigh and the elf in the end, we have the magical disappearing up the chimney with some pretty special 80s sparkles.
I've watched a couple other episodes from this 80s Twilight Zone recently, and the visual effects are abysmal.
Yeah.
It's like a step below the transporter effects in Star Trek in the 60s.
Yeah.
The other thing I thought was kind of funny is when he goes into his apartment and looks at himself in the mirror and like, oh, he got a slightly better fake beard.
Yeah, I was surprised I couldn't do any better with that. But the funny thing is, remembering it from my childhood, it was totally, and now he's got a real beard and he just went up the chimney. You know, it's we've had decades to become cynical about the effects.
Yeah,
that's true.
I think it works. That's true. It works better because it's the you know, it would be great if it was redone with a more contemporary, you know, effect available. But I think it works better than the elf. You know, the elf is just a whole nother level of silliness to it.
Well, the elf also, again, we talked about when we were talking about lateness of the hour and how the videotaped episodes always felt like stage plays a little bit. Right. And the elf feels super stage
A little, a little like, Mr. B Natural.
Yes.
Little Mr. B Natural. Knew your father, I did.
Let me dust off the seat for you, bad touch.
But I can easily see where that would translate well to a stage production, the original, whereas this was, you know, again, updated.
Mm-hmm. And his reaction, too, I always wanted to know how that worked, you know, and then he just goes up the chimney. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think that... You know, the updates, like I said, I think the thing that I respond to the most in the remake is the fact that they pared down the melodrama of the speeches a little, which, you know, even for Twilight Zone, some of those speeches were pretty hard to get through.
Yeah.
The one thing I do miss on the new one, though, I really miss the opening and closing narrations. Mm-hmm. They, for some reason, on the 80s series... They were kind of slapdash. Some episodes had them, some didn't. Right. It was a little odd.
Yeah.
And I kind of missed, especially watching the end of the episode when it's just William Atherton, like, smiling up at the sky and then, boom, like, cut to black. I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
It really needs something
more.
Yeah,
it's a little awkward.
Even if they had, like, re-recorded Sterling's original
narration.
I'm
trying to think, because the third story on this episode was also a Christmas-based one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to remember if there was a closing narration for
Not watched that. I read the story that it was based on, which doesn't help us here.
Okay, I remember seeing the episode.
I just wanted to brag about it.
It's very Star Trek-esque.
Yeah. The story was written by Arthur C. Clarke, I believe.
Okay. And basically, I mean, this is outside the purview of what we're really talking about, but it was just kind of a neat moment. That was the real heavy duty one. It's in which there are explorers and they're looking at this devastated planet. They're in the, you know, far reaches of space somewhere, in this planet that seems to have been destroyed in this giant cataclysm when a star went supernova. And they said, you know, this planet, you know, they had this wonderful civilization and all this stuff, and how could it happen? And one of the people on the starship is a chaplain, essentially. And he's having a real crisis of faith, because after they do some calculations, they realize that this star going supernova must have been the light that was interpreted on our planet as a star of Bethlehem. And he's trying to say, how could, you know, one civilization die so that we might have this? And it's the other astronaut who basically tells him, he says, well, look at everything they'd achieved. Maybe they'd kind of run their race. They'd achieved the happiness. They had the stuff we're still striving toward. And when they died, you know, it lit the way for someone who is, a people who were just getting started. It's a very, you know, philosophical, heavy episode compared to this one. And I don't remember whether it had a closing narration or not.
And another little Twilight Zone connection. Priest character is played by Fritz Weaver, who is in the episodes Third from the Sun and The Obsolete Man in the original series. So, again, we don't want to, you know, we're not discussing all the 80s Twilight Zone, but that's just kind of a neat little trivia thing.
One thing, they do keep the names of the characters in the two versions of the Night of the Meek. And Henry Corwin, it was apparently a tribute to the writer Norman Corwin, who is a personal hero of Rod Serling's. He was one of the first people to really attempt to use the medium of television as something more than just entertainment. He wanted it to be able to talk about, you know, ideas of philosophy and morality, and so he was producing these works that showed you could do, you know, popular entertainment that could still be thought provoking and deal with serious subject matter. So in calling his you know, protagonist Henry Corwin, it was Serling's tip of the hat to one of his personal idols.
Nice. All right, so that is our little holiday minisode. If you have opinions on The Night of the Meek versus Night of the Meek, if you feel like Art Carney wipes the floor with Richard Mulligan, or if you think that William Atherton could totally take Piglet down, let us know. Come join us on Facebook at SSM Podcast, or you can follow us on Instagram at SSM Podcast. Be sure to send us your response, your hate mail, or your thanks for this lovely Christmas present to SSMpodcast@gmail.com.
And you can always tell us what you'd like to find in your stocking as well for future episodes.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Ken, did you come up with a catchphrase for our special holiday minisode?
I would just say Merry Christmas and Happy New Year's Marathon, everybody.
That's right. New Year's Marathon coming up. Be sure to watch your favorites so you can give us requests on which ones you want us to talk about.
That's right.
Happy holidays, everybody. Stay safe, stay happy, and we'll see you next time.
See you in the new year.
All right, bye-bye.
Cold Pop!